Good morning. Thanks for your patience. Got a lot of brain power up here, but we're still flummoxed by an RCA cable. So. Happens to the best of us. Welcome to the Game Perverts panel. Pardon the cheeky title. It's not perverts as in deviants and things like that, but it's people who pervert games, namely for non-game purposes. So we got a really all-star group up here to show off some stuff, and it's hacking, it's modding, and even the presentation is a bit of a hack because of this RCA cable thing. So thanks for your patience, and glad to be here. I'm going to start off and introduce our panel, starting from your left. Rich LeGrand, right here, is with a group called Charm Labs, and they do. Rich was one of the first people to hack a Game Boy, and Charm Labs does educational technologies for high schools and junior highs. One of the things it does, it's the hardware provider, the robotic provider for BotBall, which is a national robotics competition for is it high school or junior high?
High school.
Yeah. And also works with Carnegie Mellon on a Google-funded project called
Gigapan.
And he lives here in Austin, and he has a comp sci background and has worked in robotics and I guess has a double E degree, actually. On my other side is Bob Sabiston, who's also from Austin, who has a company called Flat Black Films. It's perhaps best known for his film work, done a huge number of features and shorts. Some of the most widely seen are the Richard Linklater animated films, A Scanner Darkly and Waking Life. Bob created the rotoscoping technology that gave those movies their distinctive look. And now his work is also seen widely on national television. He's done a series of commercials for Charles Schwab called Talk to Chuck. You might have seen around little shorts of people, talking heads, chatting. In addition to his film work and his shorts, he also writes software for graphics tools to help people use animation and art tools in new and different ways, and that's what he's going to talk about today. He's done a homebrew application for the Nintendo DS that's getting the best of us this morning. And he has a background in visual studies, so he's kind of a double threat with his art and technology. Similar double thread is Paul Slocum, who's on the end of the table here, comes to us from Dallas, Texas. Paul does lots of different things. He has a comp sci background, but a lot of his stuff now comes out through the art vein. He's part of the band Tree Wave that performs around all over. In fact, they'll be here later this month at the Alamo Draft House. Paul is featured in the film 8-Bit that debuted in October in New York and has been touring around the nation. And he'll be here at the end of the month, and Paul will be performing with that. He also is a co-owner of the Andor Gallery in Dallas that focuses on new media. And Paul himself does a lot of art, both digital art and other art, shown in galleries around the world. And he has a comp sci background. So thanks, everyone, for being here. We're going to start off doing a little show and tell. We're going to have people go down the line, and we're going to show off some of the toys they brought for you this morning, and then we'll have some discussion and questions at the end. So we're going to start off with Rich LeGrand of Charm Labs. Take it, Rich.
Thanks, Rodney. I thought I'd kind of go over kind of the motivation behind hacking the Game Boy, because I don't think it's necessarily obvious, why someone would want to do that. So it was back, I think it was back in like 2000, I had the desire to build a robot, and what I needed was, every robot needs a brain, so I needed some kind of computer that was small, portable, inexpensive. It would be nice to have an LCD, maybe some cool sound. I started looking around, and there's really nothing like that you can buy. If you had $100,000, you could contract and get a design, but I had, roughly $100, and So I kind of detailed some of the truths of hacking on this slide. And what I came to conclusion was that no one really was interested in my $100. It just wasn't much money to undertake some big engineering effort. I also found out that there was nothing out there that did exactly what I wanted. So what I ended up having to do was adapt something that wasn't really, you know, intended for the purpose. In this case, controlling a robot. So about this time, the Game Boy Advance came out. This was 2001. And it had, you know, this really great list of features, you know, a big 32-bit processor, color LCD, really good graphics and sound, low power, low cost, and you could buy it basically anywhere. So just to some context, these are Game Boys. I'm sure everyone's seen them. The first foray into this was to, you know, build something that would allow you to, you know, essentially program the Game Boy and hook up devices to it. So I had to design this thing that I eventually called the X-Port. And it does basically what you expect. It allows you to, if you're going to build a robot, you want to hook up motors and sensors and that kind of stuff. And so that's what the X-Port allows you to do. You plug it into the Game Boy, and out of the back of it, you have some connectors that you can interface stuff to, you know, sensors, motors, whatever you want. But it required some reverse engineering of the Game Boy's cartridge port. So normally, you know, the Game Boy has a cartridge that you plug in. In this case, I wanted to plug in a robot, and they don't really, you know, provide documentation on how to do this. So I had to, you know, essentially reverse engineer it and figure out exactly how they're doing it. And in the process, you know, there's patents and there's copyrights concerning the cartridge port. Once I had done this, I thought, you know, this is kind of a cool device. You know, other people might want to hook up stuff to the Game Boy. And so I thought, it'd be cool to maybe sell this commercially. But the question was, you know, what will Nintendo do? Or, like, will they come after me? And it was, you know, kind of tough to decide, you know, well, I can't get permission, right? I mean, you can write as many letters as you want to Nintendo, right? But they're not really going to respond and say, sure, no problem. So I had to kind of trudge forward and just kind of hope that, you know, they wouldn't mind. And so that's eventually what I did. And so it's been about 4 years that I've been selling the X-Port, and no one's come after me yet. So keep my fingers crossed. And so what I eventually did, my main goal was to quit my day job, and I needed to find an application for this X-Port. And it turned out that my original idea of making it into a robot had some traction with a nonprofit called BotBall. And what they did is they contracted with us, and we designed a robot controller around the X-Port, and they use it these days as a robot controller. So in a lot of kids nowadays in high schools and middle schools, they'll learn engineering through playing with robots, and a lot of schools are offering these kind of curricula. And So it's, I guess it's a happy ending. I was able to quit my day job.
Yay.
So I brought a robot. This is a Game Boy robot. On the top here, standard Game Boy. And all these electronics here is what we design and manufacture. And on the bottom is, some Legos. And what typically happens is the kids design the Lego part, and they program the robot to do whatever they want it to do. And on the slide here, you see, you know, on the upper right, there's a typical robot made out of Legos holding a ball. On the kind of upper left, there's kind of the arena that these robots kind of interact in. You know, they're kind of going head to head and trying to, you know, steal balls from each other and score points. And so let me just go ahead and do a quick demo. I don't have too much space here, but oops. So what I'll do is I'll teach it a little dance. So it's going to do what I told it to do. So, yay. So that's basically my dog and pony.
Is that it?
That's it, yeah.
Maybe more stuff?
That's it.
That's it?
That's
right.
It.
And quit your day job for that.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly.
That's great. All right, thanks, Rich. And we'll come back to Rich with some more stuff later. Want to go to you now, or do you want to go to Paul and give him more time? I did send a text message trying to get another projector. So. Can we go to you, Paul? Is that all right? Buy a little more time for Bob. This is Paul Slocum.
Hey. Okay, I'm going to talk a little bit about my band, which is it's called Tree Wave, and it's a band that I put together, and I use a bunch of old video game equipment and computer equipment to make music. So it involves a Atari 2600 console, video game console, which is like from the 70s, Commodore 64's, home computers from the 80s, and a dot matrix printer from the 80s, and then a DOS PC from the 80s. So I'm going to start off talking about the printer project that I did. Okay, this is a Epson LQ500 dot matrix printer that came out in around 1985. Okay, so What I did to make this printer make music was I reprogrammed the firmware in it. The printer actually has a computer inside it, which it's kind of funny because the computer actually is more powerful than some of the computers it was hooked up to, and so it has a little chip inside and you can reprogram it. And so I reverse engineered this printer and wrote my own software that instead of taking signals from the computer and telling it to print out stuff, it's just a standalone unit that you can play like a synthesizer. And so I also, okay, so it has like a 2-octave range, and I also made it so as you play it, it prints out these series of images that I took from the internet. And this is like about three pages that it prints out. And I would dye the ribbons, which is why it's red and gold. So the sound that you know, I don't know, maybe people haven't seen dot matrix printers anymore, but they're really loud because there's little pins that shoot out of the print head and strike the paper through it with a ribbon in between, and that's how it prints. So it's a pretty loud process. So the way I made it make music was just to change the timing of that printing process. So if you change the timing, it changes the pitch. And here's a little bit of the tech details. It's a 7810 NEC processor, and it's 256K RAM. And so this EEPROM has all the firmware that I rewrote. And I used the font expansion port to plug an interface, like there's little cartridges you could stick in it to get new fonts, and so I would I made this like button interface that plugs into that port, and you can see it plugged in here. This is the main board for it. That's a schematic that I worked off of. Okay, now I'm going to go back a little bit. My original idea with this printer was to make a Mellotron. I don't know if you've seen those, but like the Beatles and Led Zeppelin used it. It was like the first sampler. And it was this big, ridiculous device where it was a keyboard, but each key had a tape loop on it. So every key that you press, it actually plays a tape. And so it'd have strings or like, you know, all these different instruments on it. So I had this idea to make my own using the printer roller and like gluing tape to the print roller and taking a Walkman and taking the head out and putting it on the outside and then just kind of holding it up to these pieces of tape as it rolled around. It actually, I got it working, but it wasn't very reliable. I'm gonna skip to a little bit of audio samples. So this is when I got the Mellotron thing working, and then as I started taking this printer apart and getting all this stuff, I realized I could rewrite the firmware and make it actually the print head play music. So this is a sample of me playing the Mellotron thing and the printer playing music. Anyway. Yeah, it's pretty cool for like a printer, right? So that's some about the printer and how I did all that ridiculous process to make that thing work. And so, let's see, what next? I'll go on to some videos of the band. So the band is like the printer, which has pre-programmed sequences, and then like the Atari 2600, which I reprogrammed to make sound and do the video for the live shows, and then the Commodore 64, which I play like a keyboard now, so I wrote my own software. So I'll play a video. This is a video I made with all this instrumentation, but I took the Atari game Combat, which was like the first pack-in game that came with the Atari, and I modified it so that it has a music player in the background, and as the song progresses, it lays music data into the game's data area, so the game kind of deconstructs as the song goes along. How am I doing on time?
About two more minutes.
Okay. Okay, I'm going to show just a little bit of this video, which will show you a little bit more of, you can kind of see the printer working. The upper left is Atari, and the lower right is Commodore 64, and then the printer, of course, is in the lower left. The upper right is a Pixel Vision camera. That's on YouTube. You can watch the rest of it. Okay, I'm going to show one more thing. I'm going to show some of my work that doesn't involve video game stuff, but it's kind of similar. This is a video I made. I made a homepage on the internet, and it was a homepage that had MIDI files in the background that was kind of like late 90s style. And so I continually made changes to it and used images from the internet. And each time I made a change to it, I took a screenshot of it and took a 1/20th of a second sample of the sound that was playing on the page from the MIDI files. And so then it sort of evolves from my early web page to my current web page. So it's a time lapse. It's called a time lapse homepage. And that's pretty much what it is. It's like 1,000 screenshots of a homepage that ends up being about a minute long. So this is it. I guess that's it. Thanks.
Thank you, Paul. All right, Bob Sabson's up next, and we have to apologize to Bob because we have it's not the ideal situation. Bob has developed his homebrew app on the Nintendo DS, which is a very popular handheld game system. And normally we play these through what's called a development kit. It's a blue box over there. That's what people who make the games use. Maybe this is our projector. What they use to make it. But we've had some connection problems getting it onto our device. So Bob is going to have to use the camera on the
Yeah. Perverted demonstration.
The perverted demonstration.
Does this mic work?
Is that mic work?
Hello?
Oh,
Maybe I'll just do it from the side. Okay. See how this is going to work. I don't know how well the DS screen is going to pick up on this thing, but we'll see. Let's see. Maybe I'll do it like this. Sorry for putting my turning it back to you. Okay.
Hey, you got a projector?
Thank you very much. We'll chat for a minute. Taylor.
Okay, so we're going to chat for a minute and give them a chance because Bob's stuff is great and it deserves to be seen properly. And he's got a, he'll tell you about this too. He's selling these out in the lobby, I think. This is some of the artwork he's done on his application. But we'll give them a minute to set this stuff up. Okay, I'm going to hold them. All right. Is it okay? Won't crush someone in the front row. So I'll start off and ask a few questions, give them a couple minutes to get this stuff set up. So start with both you guys, but Rich especially. You're talking about Nintendo getting their permission. Do they take notice of this stuff, or are they trying to cultivate a third-party or aftermarket culture or hardware development for their products, or do you think you're totally off the radar with this stuff?
Yeah, I'm curious, right, if they actually know about it. But if you go to like Toys R Us and to the Game Boy section, most of the stuff there is third party, unlicensed. So they do try to view a lot of that as kind of complementary to their products. When it comes to stuff that actually renders software on their platform, because their business model entails, they essentially publish all titles, and every software title is essentially distributed through them, and they get the royalties. So there's that risk, but I think us kind of going for the kind of educational spin, lends kind of a happy face to the whole thing.
Well, the maker of LSDJ. Do you know about LSDJ? It's a sequencer tool for the Game Boy, and he actually makes a living off of selling those. And it's the same way you're doing it. It's like under the radar, and they've left him alone. So I guess they don't seem to mess with people. Atari did come after us for we were selling these. Well, it was like a hacked combat cartridge that played. Well, we call it Combat Rock, and it plays Rock the Casbah in the background when you play. And Atari did make us stop selling those. It's kind of a gray area, but we can't really fight them, So,
yeah, I think in general they leave us alone. There's one company that came up with something called the Song Boy, which allowed you to play MP3s, and Nintendo came after them because they were using the boy in their name.
Oh, right. Yeah,
and so they got them to change their name, but that was it. Yeah.
So, Paul, with your stuff, it seemed like there's a lot of increasingly there's galleries and recognition of games and manipulation of digital art as more legit and more mainstream art. And are you seeing that with your gallery and you tour around a lot? Or is it being embraced by a bigger audience, or is that stuff? How's that feeding out?
A little bit, yeah. I don't know of any major museums that have stuff in their collection. But actually, the group Jody, Jody.org, we're showing them, I was just telling you about that, we're showing them, in a couple of months. And they did a lot of Max Payne cheat stuff, and they did Doom hacks, or they were doing Quake hacks, where, the whole game is white and stuff like that. They originally were web artists, but I think they're going to be showing simultaneously in New York with our show, and there's a chance that the MoMA in New York may acquire something from that show. So it's broken when museums have this stuff in their collection. I don't know of any that do yet. Mm-hmm. But there are some large galleries that are showing some digital and video game based stuff.
Mm-hmm. Get Bob going. Is it just showing one screen?
Yeah. Do you know if there's a way to show both? I know we have that set.
Yeah. I'm not sure why it wouldn't. Any questions from the audience? We'll give Bob another minute.
Yeah, I mean, would you still be using the Nintendo or DS? Would you be starting the DS, or would you be using other equipment today for some of your hacks? Is there commercial equipment that's cheaper?
Oh, you mean like are there platforms nowadays?
Yeah.
It turns out that the at least in our customer, the Botball, they like the Game Boy Advance just because you can get them used for like $20. So there's this, you know, influx of really cheap hardware. But it, like the DS, is that? We like the Game Boy for that. Reason, you know, there's a lot of hardware out there, and it seems like as more people buy the DS, you know, they'll be, and they're still selling the Game Boy, you know, along with the DS, you know, it's kind of like a lower cost alternative.
So which models is your hardware compatible with?
With the Advance.
The Advance.
But you know, the DS will play right. Advance games,
but
so you can use it on the
DS. It's not original Game Boy, it's Advance.
Right.
Did you consider any other hardware? Like the Sega stuff or anything?
Yeah, I was looking at cell phones.
Oh,
you know,
right.
It's a possible platform because they have a pretty powerful processor and you know, yeah. but cell phones the life cycle for those are you know like typically a year or before the end of life, and so the Game Boy is nice because the original Game Boy was sold for like 15 years, which is that's a long time for a piece of computer hardware. So
there's millions of them in existence.
So I mean, I like the fact that you know this. You know, I guess it's I can say that I you know I picked it because of that.
Yeah,
but anyway, that's one of the advantages.
You bought how many boxes of them for nothing? It's like 50 Game Boys at a time.
Yeah, there's. There was something on Engadget a couple years ago where the Botball guys, so I think it's GameStop. They're like a retailer and they also have an online presence, and they're the main aggregators of these used Game Boys, and they called Botball called them up and said, hey, you know, we want to buy 500. Will you give us a discount? And they actually said, no, actually, we want to sell them to you for $10 more, because we use these used Game Boys as a way to bring customers in the store and sell more titles and that kind of stuff. And so just on a whim, they went to their online site and you know punched in 1,000 for the quantity, and it went through, and they got this big, you know, almost pallet sized box full of Game Boys one day, and so they took a bunch of pictures of that, and it kind of had its 15 minutes of fame on the web. That was kind of funny.
Okay, I think Bob's ready, and we still have tech problems in that the DS has two screens. It's a dual-screen device, and looks like we're only showing one screen. Is that right?
Yep.
So you afterwards come up and look over Bob's shoulder. He'll show it to you.
Yeah.
It's really cool on both screens, but he can toggle back and forth, as he'll tell you.
Yeah, I may switch it out to show you the top screen once or twice, but you could pretty much get the gist of it just off of one screen. So should I go ahead and start?
Yeah. Do you want me to hold your mic? Or?
No, it's okay. I think I can deal with it. So this is a little DS application that I've been writing. And okay, thanks. Basically, the idea was I played around with Game Boys the past couple years, and I always kind of wanted to write something for them just because I'm interested in software. And when the DS came out, I really got excited about it because it comes with a little pen, a little stylus, and you sort of, a lot of the games you draw with the stylus on the screen. So I just, I wrote Nintendo a letter and said that I was a accomplished software person, and I had an idea for a paint and animation program on the DS. And so they gave me a developer license, and I got access to the software tools and compiler and et cetera. And so I just started working on this little program to do sort of like little low-res bitmap drawings, which is what I kind of grew up doing, making little icons and things. And so it's just sort of a simple little paint program. And I've just been working on it on and off for the past year, slowly adding little features to it. It has, as you can see, you can change the resolution. You have different kind of color palettes that you can choose. You can mix your own colors. If you pick out colors that you like, you can add them to the palette. So I'm just adding like all the basics that you would need to do little digital drawings on the DS. I have you can't see the top screen in this case is just showing the whole image at all times. The bottom screen, you see sort of a zoomed in area of whatever you're working on. So I have different, you know, sort of tools. This is a paintbrush. There's a setting that will make the brush thicker the faster you draw, so you can get a real nice organic sort of line. You can use the little D-pad, sort of the direction pad, to scroll around on your big screen. And like I said, on the top screen, you just see an overall view of your whole canvas. You have control over the opacity of your line. So just trying to aim for a sort of a basic but full set of drawing tools. You have a little flood fill where you can fill solid areas of color. You have a little shape tool where you can outline an area and it'll fill it in with a shape, circles. And so the cool thing also about the DS is it has built-in wireless. So although the game cart itself doesn't have much space, you could probably save a handful of drawings that you did this way. If you are close to a Wi-Fi spot, then that basically gives you unlimited storage because you could store straight to a website. And so that's the plan with this. I'm working with Alan Watts, who does Micons and ToonFu and Pixel Tees. And he's going to work on the front end for the website so that people will be able to have their accounts and save their artwork and share it wirelessly. So the second component of this, this is where it sort of helps to see the top screen, but it's sort of the same idea. Just sort of applied to flipbooks. So you do simple animations just using the same drawing tool. So you just have a sequence of frames. And, you know, kids, when you first learn about animation, you always draw a little flip book. And so that's what this lets you do. And you have, you can turn on onion skinning, so you can see the frame that came before it. And then you hold down the D-pad to just sort of run through your frames. Sort of hear that. And you can also run through and fill these. You also have a clear color for making sort of sprites that don't have a background, and that becomes useful later when I have sort of a mode where you can overlay animated shapes over a background. So one thing, the animation you saw a second ago was just a more polished one. Let's see, where is that? So just, I'm going to pull this video cable out for a second just so you can see what is on the top screen. This is just you have a thumbnail view of all your frames, and then over on the right, just sort of a frame timing and the frame size. So I'll put that back on the bottom screen. And then that's sort of the initial version. I'd like to I'm really interested in what it would take to actually make a real product, because I've never sold any of my software. The stuff we use for Waking Life, et cetera, is all in-house, and I don't really want to figure out the business of software or selling through that. So this seems like a simple way to do it, and I'm kind of trying to pursue right now with Nintendo selling this in some form. However, I'm also working on expanding this a little bit. I have this sort of, I won't really go into this much because it really uses both screens, but I can switch them. This is one screen and this is the other screen, and I'm using a key to toggle between them. So on one screen you have your tools and the other screen you have your canvas. And this third sort of animation mode is more of a vector art mode where you have a little timeline and you can scroll back and forth. And on your canvas, you can build objects and keyframe them. You sort of change their properties, their color, their position, stuff like that. And you can also take flipbooks that you took that you'd made in the flipbook mode and sort of overlay those. And the idea is that you could sort of composite little scenes. And then that's cool. So that's pretty much it. And the DS also has a built-in microphone. So kind of interested in having you be able to record little sound effects. And then the ultimate idea was that you could sit at home and make little animated scenes and then publish them to the web just wirelessly and build a website or, you know, a little daily comic or something. So that's the idea. Oh, and then that's a print I made. Hold on just 1 second. So this is that image. Just as an example of the kind of thing that really inspired me to do this is that I like just sit at home in front of the TV and, well, now you can't see the lower screen, but you see that little box scrolling around. That's what you'd see blown up on the bottom screen. And so I just like the idea of like slowly filling in an entire image with little tiny pixel-based graphics. So once I filled in a couple of these images, I started getting them printed to canvas and just stretched out. And I actually run that through a Macintosh. If you come up afterwards, you look real close. Each pixel is actually like a little shaded rectangle. That's done on the Mac. But the base image is the kind of thing that I envision using this for. So that's it. Thank you, Bob.
Glad we got to show it. Okay. So I work in traditional game development, and one of our things is that no person is an island. We always have to work in a team, but all three of you are three solid islands, working on your own on games or game applications. Is there much room for collaboration, or is this, by definition, is this kind of like this solitary endeavor that just it's suited well to a single person? Is there much collaboration on your side and people working on this stuff?
I know other artists who have collaborated. I haven't really that much. I've considered it, but it's kind of it's like a collaboration as a project in itself, I guess. And I haven't taken it on yet.
Mm-hmm. How about either of you?
Yeah, I think it was interesting when I first started. The Game Boy hadn't even come out in the U.S. yet. It was released in Japan 6 months before, and already the cat was kind of out of the bag. Nintendo came out with a document that kind of detailed all the hardware specs, and it kind of got distributed around the internet, and all these bootleg, fully implemented software emulators were starting to be written, and by the time the Game Boy was released in the U.S., you could download basically a Game Boy for your PC, and you could play games that were already hacked. So there was like this really amazing kind of hacker community that kind of grew up out of the Game Boy, and it's still there's still a lot of resources out on the web. It was very surprising. I didn't expect. It's a huge presence there. You can buy, but there's programs for making bitmap editors for the Game Boy. There's programs, like I said, there's like three or four emulators, written by different folks, as well as there's a lot of bootleg software out there as well. But
that one thing that it's always amazed me that these big teams of software could do things, because software is such a in your head sort of thing, and it is sort of collaboration does seem to be a problem with me as far as software goes. Like with animation, it's real easy, but with this project, it's interesting because I've got Alan who's doing the web stuff, and I'm doing the DS, and we'll be collaborating a lot that way.
But. Any questions out here? Yes, sir.
It's 256 by 192.
More questions? Yes.
How do we get started? Like, I have like a very last thing back
the question is how to get started. Where do you look for ideas and resources?
I know that I think there's some if you're interested in the DS, there's some DS emulators, isn't that right, that you can get. And that's, you know, really low overhead way to go about it. You just download them and you can write the software using you know, like GCC or whatever, you know, that's the usual compiler that's used. Yeah. There's that route. I mean, actually, you know, rendering the code on the hardware, and I think that might be more difficult than actually, you know, just doing it on an emulator or something. But
the with this thing, I don't, those machines there cost $2,000, and I'm not going to buy one until I know there's a chance to sell the thing. So I've been developing just with sort of similar to what you have, buy this little thing on the internet. And what it does is it allows the DS to read the program information from this Game Boy Advance cartridge, which is rewritable. So if you write stuff, I was using an emulator at first, but it's actually much more satisfying if you can actually sit here and use a little pen and the sound works and everything. So that's an excellent place to start. As far as documentation, there's places. I know there's a one website called gbadev.org and I think dsdev.org. Where they have sort of communities of developers, and there's different libraries of sort of development tools you can download. There's one called Ham, I know, that has just sort of the basic stuff that you need to compile and run programs. So if you start at that dsdev.org, I think you could probably find a map to the other stuff.
Are there communities for the more old school platforms as well, or
yeah? I mean, it's pretty much the same thing. There's, you know, there's communities out there that do all kinds of stuff, Commodore or Atari or whatever.
Was there stuff you could glean or, you know, steal from that to get to take some shortcuts, or just to really do everything from scratch on your stuff?
Yeah, there's some. Well, like the combat code, with somebody had already disassembled it, so that made it a lot easier. But also everything, like these old computers, the Atari you can only program in assembly. So all the stuff I do is in assembly language.
Wow. And then once you have a product, I mean, it's a little different on each side of the table, but I'm curious how you get it out there. I'm like, Rich, you're trying to kind of monetize yours and make a living from it, whereas you're, I think, more trying to entertain and educate and illuminate people. But, you know, is it all word of mouth and viral stuff, or is there any type of process you go through to distribute the stuff and get it known?
It's all blogs for me,
yeah.
Pretty much.
So one blog picks up on it and it spreads, people start learning about it?
Yeah, there's sort of a, I mean, there's a community of, sort of a group of artists that we all have blogs and we all read each other's blogs. So you kind of keep up with what's going on and see what everybody's working on. And Delicious feeds too, which are kind of interesting because then you can see what links artist you're interested in or bookmarking.
Mm-hmm.
Those blogs are powerful. I heard some of Paul's music before I even knew who he was on the on satellite radio a couple weeks. They have a Sirius has this nightly show that they get blog owners to actually program the music, and they played some of his stuff like 2 weeks ago.
How about you, Rich? How did, are you going door to door with your robot, or what do you do?
It was. I think I struggled for about 2 years trying to find a commercial venue for it. And I was selling stuff online. I think, yeah, most of it was being promoted within the kind of Game Boy hacker community, you know, which is, you know, very, very limited, of course. I got some magazine articles written and, you know, through like Dr. Dobbs Journal and, there's another kind of geeky publication called Circuit Seller that ran an article, and that's kind of how it caught on eventually. And then I got hooked up with the Botball guys.
Mm-hmm. And Bob, would you have, sound like you would have done yours anyway, whether or not it sells or not? It was just a hobby you were goofing off with.
It was just a hobby. I mean, after a while, it sort of took over. I was spending so much time on it that it really got past the point where I wanted to do it. I kind of thought I should try to seek some way to distribute it. And I'm doing that now, but I don't really know how if it's going to happen or not.
All right. We got a couple minutes left. Any more questions? Yes, sir. So the question is, when your hobby starts taking over, how do you handle that? And if you're trying to make a living, how do you go about that?
I don't know. It's extremely difficult. My schedule is insane right now.
Because you've got a day job, and you're running the gallery, and you're doing the band. And
I have a lot of things going on. And the gallery takes a massive amount of time. I make the most money selling artwork.
Your own or through the gallery?
My own. Uh-huh. The gallery doesn't make any money.
Your art finances the gallery?
I mean, aside from my day job, which I'm actually about to quit. And then I also do advertising music, actually, like TV ads and stuff. But yeah, from that stuff, I make the most money selling like just my artwork to like actually mainly one collector in Belgium. But also, I mean, other people who have done this stuff, like LSDJ, I know that guy makes a lot of money. Another interesting one is the Homestar Runner guys. Do you know Homestar Runner? Like, those guys are rich. And I was doing an Atari game for them. I know them. But, like, they just sell merchandise. They don't have any advertising on their website. They just started selling T-shirts, and they made, like, so much money off of that. So, I don't know. You never know.
Did you get some Tree Wave shirts?
We don't have two-way shirts. I keep procrastinating on that.
I mean, you were doing stuff on the side. I know you had Rich and I went to college together. So, I mean, you were in a lot of unhappy jobs in the tech field and trying to do the stuff on the side. Like, what was it that finally made you take the plunge and quit the day job?
Yeah, I mean, I was fortunate in that I could, I guess unbeknownst to the company I was working for, I could, code while I was at work and they were none the wiser. But I really hated my job. I mean, it was a well-known fact. Do you have a mother-in-law? That's what helped. I ended up moving in with my mother-in-law for 2 years and,
So you can start the company?
Yeah. We moved to New Jersey, which, was quite a sacrifice. But
and what was the town called, by the way?
It's a beautiful hamlet called Hohokus. And so if you're trying to run a tech business from Hohokus, New Jersey, it doesn't really, inspire much. Anyway, so that's what I did. 2 years in New Jersey was kind of the penance I had to pay for... But it worked out in the end, so it's a good question.
And Bob, you've been doing the rotoscope stuff for years. I mean, back to MTV, Liquid Television.
Yep.
Were you doing other stuff before then that you had like a straight job and this was a side thing? Or?
I'm
about to get closer.
Not really. I've been able to sort of support myself at least just through shorts and contests and stuff since I got out of college. But when I first got out of college, I was just doing sort of more typical animated shorts. The rotoscoping stuff... we've been doing about 10 years now, and it started off as an MTV project, and somehow each project has led to the next. I'm never really sure where we're going to make money, but people see the look, and they'll come to us, and, it just seems like projects sort of come along if you keep working on, what you like or making something that looks good, so people will want that.
One more question, or else we're going to wrap it up and let you come check out the toys up here. Oh, comic cards. You have comic cards in your chair. Please fill those out. It helps a lot for them to evaluate panels and figure out if people want more of this or less of this or more technical difficulties or less technical difficulties. So appreciate you coming. Thanks a lot to Bob Sabiston, Rich LeGrand, and Paul Slocum.